Alan Giebert grew up on a farm and has written about agriculture for two decades, including newspaper columns of what life was like on what he calls the Southern Illinois dairy farm of his youth, and the great uncle who came to help. From those columns and stories, Giebert and his daughter have compiled a new book, The Land of Milk and Uncle Honey. Giebert came by WILL to talk with me about the book and how he sees agriculture returning to the way it was 50 years ago.
My daughter, Mary Grace, asked me to put together all the columns that I'd ever written about, as I call it, the Southern Illinois dairy farm of my youth. She's just 30, and I've been writing the column for 22 years. So for many, many years, she didn't see any of the columns that I wrote. And when I did, I discovered I had 60 columns that I had written over those 22 years. And then she read them. She's quite an editor, and she said immediately, "You have a book here." And whether I thought I had a book in it didn't matter, because I would have never gotten around to doing it. Gracie got around to doing it. She's the one who then organized all the columns, edited each one that she wanted, put them in the chapters, put them in order in the chapters, had me write a prologue, had me write a second prologue. She didn't think the first one was very good. And then she wrote an epilogue. And then she found the publisher, University of Illinois Press. So it came about simply because of Gracie, our daughter.
And Gracie is with you for this book tour, even though she's not here today. She'll be here this weekend.
Right. She'll be here this weekend. And she's a go-getter, and she's a terrific editor. And by that I mean, when I'm done, I'm done. I have said it exactly in the manner I wish to say it. But you always read what you write, and you say, "Ooh, boy, I'm pretty good." And then when Gracie gets done with it, you read it, and you go, "I'm really good," because you can't see what she did. And that's the mark of a really good editor. They make you a better writer.
Mm-hmm. So I think kind of the main character is the farm that you grew up on. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
The farm was put together by my grandfather, who was not a farmer. My grandfather worked in St. Louis at a brokerage firm called Reinholdt & Gardner, and he was a bond broker. And as such, he had clients throughout Southern Illinois whose money he invested. And he put together a pool of money and bought nearly 1,000 acres in one patch right where the Kaskaskia River runs into the Mississippi River. And that was long known by the locals as Indian Farm, because the Kaskaskia Indians had their village there for several hundred years. And then in 1953, he asked my father to go down and manage Indian Farm and put a 100-cow dairy on the farm. But nobody put a 100-cow dairy in back. That would be like putting a 5,000-cow dairy today. And by golly, that's what they did. That became the Indian Farm and the big dairy farm of my youth.
When people see the title, they go, "Who's Uncle Honey?" So who is Uncle Honey?
Well, Uncle Honey of the title, the book is titled The Land of Milk and Uncle Honey. And by the way, that title, I confess, I did not come up with, nor did Gracie come up with. The good people at the University of Illinois Press came up with it. And they were kind of fearful when they suggested it to us. And I don't know why, because it's absolutely perfect. Uncle Honey was indeed my father's uncle, who was the local milkman in town. And when he retired from that milk route, he showed up on the farm, this was in the early 1960s, and announced that he was there to help. My father was not anxious to hire his Uncle Honey, because he used to run the milk route with Uncle Honey. And the one thing he remembered clearly was that Honey never used a clutch when shifting the milk truck. And every piece of equipment on the farm had a clutch. So he knew he was in for a big metal-bending adventure, and he was. Uncle Honey was quite a character. He was a key part of my growing up. He was part of the extended German family that most farms back then had. And he ate dinner with us every day at noon. He'd show up at 7 in the morning and go to work. He would work till 6 p.m. each night. He would take us boys to the ball game in St. Louis. He didn't have any sons of his own, so he adopted my older brothers and me. I got to tell you, as a kid growing up on the farm with Uncle Honey, it was kind of neat to watch what Uncle Honey did. I mean, cows feared him and dogs ran, but we loved to watch him. He would do all kinds of crazy things.
Very cool. So he ran through a large number of farm equipment. It does make me wonder how many milk trucks he went through.
It's hard to say. I remember as a young boy, we loved staying at his house in town. He had a walk-in cooler in the basement. And in that walk-in cooler, believe it or not, were cartons of chocolate milk. Now, we had dairy cows, but we never had chocolate dairy cows. So we just drank chocolate milk till we burst at Uncle Honey's and his wife's Aunt Esther's house. It was so great.
Sounds wonderful. I thought it was interesting in the way you structure the book. You go from a fun, lighthearted Uncle Honey story to an article you wrote about farm safety for just kids and farm accidents. Farm Safety for Just Kids is working to try and avoid farm accidents. What made you decide to put them in that order?
Well, Gracie put them in order, but she also selected them. And I would have put that story in the book, too. When I was a kid on the farm, every kid on every farm worked. Everybody on that farm at one time or another was probably injured due to real careful inattention to detail. You were running some massive farm machines. You were running some dangerous machines. Even cows were dangerous. So I put that in there because I was hurt, seriously hurt on the farm. I was about 10 years old, and it was an injury that should not have happened. And it wasn't an injury that you could blame on anyone. It was just me being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But still, I was in the wrong place. I shouldn't have been there at all. And you and I or anyone else would never have put their 10-year-old today in that situation. We wouldn't put a 10-year-old on a tractor and expect him to do almost a man's work. But it was thoughtlessly done back then. Growing up on a big farm wasn't all roses and peaches. It was sweat, and it was Band-Aids, and it was a trip to the hospital every now and then.
As you've established, you talk mostly about what's happening in agriculture. In the book, you talk a lot about how agriculture has changed.
It's so far, far more productive. We've taken our lessons from AgEcon 100 and all AgEcon and farm management classes, and we've applied them. We've taken the elements of agriculture, land, labor, capital, and management, and we've done what our professors told us to do. We've taken capital and replaced labor. We've taken blood and skin and brains, just replaced it with iron. Iron never complains, never goes on vacation, doesn't need medical care, and it's 10 times more productive. I like to say 100 years ago, the number one crop in America was oats. Oats. Now we import oats. We grow so few. So that's how it's changed.
Mm-hmm. Would you personally say that's progress or is that a problem?
Well, progress is a pretty subjective word. So I don't know what progress is in modern agriculture. If progress is production, we're great. If progress is profitability, we're not so great.
You also talk a lot of the farmhands that worked with you and your father and your brothers and some of the lessons that you learned from them.
Well, we learned a lot of lessons from the hired men. And as I note in one of the columns in the book, that my mother was contemptuous of many of the lessons that these worldly men taught us. Something lost in the last generation was exactly those types of people in American agriculture. For centuries, they were everywhere on American farms. There was a whole economic strata or class of people who were either tenant farms or they were hired men. And they were all over our farm. These were great workmen. They were just strong, hardworking people who worked 6 days a week from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., 51 weeks a year, all for about $1 an hour. And I never heard them complain. Never. And then they showed us how to work. And if we complained, they worked harder, and they shamed us by that hard work. So we learned a lot of lessons and weren't taught by them in any lecture at all. Then they taught us other things, you know, like how to roll cigarettes and how to hunt and fish. Fun things.
Mm-hmm. Is there one particular story that is kind of your favorite?
No, I have quite a few favorites. But there are some in here that stand out. And there's a column in here called People Are As Important As Land. And I wrote that almost 20 years ago to the day. And I remember exactly why I wrote it. My father was selling the farm. And I read it today, and it reads as good as it ever read. And I still feel the same warm anger boiling up in me as I did when I wrote it. And, of course, the title gives it away. I think we emphasize the land so much that we look right past the people who work that land. And I don't think that land is as important as those people, their lives or their future. I don't think that land is as important as what comes off of that land. But I know a lot of people in American agriculture would strongly disagree with me. And you know what? I'm okay with that. I'm just okay with that. What I write is what I believe. And what I believe is always in the column.
How did you start writing your column?
It starts here in Champaign. I left the University of Illinois three times. Twice when I ran out of money, and once when one of the deans at the College of Agriculture thought it might be a good thing that I'd go work on a farm someplace. But he said, when you come back, and when you want to come back, you come and see me. And that's exactly what happened. So when I came back, put me on a B-plus probation. I'd never gotten a B-plus average in my life, maybe Lutheran school when I was fourth grade. So I took some writing classes because I knew I could write, and I always enjoyed writing. So one thing led to another, and after writing almost 14 years as a magazine writer, I started the column because I always wanted to have a column in the Bloomington Pantograph. And the column is in there now. So I finally got back to the Pantograph.
I'm glad. So what was it like working with your daughter on the book?
Well, like I said, she's a great editor. It took my getting used to her being my editor. But I think I've had just about the best experience a father can have, working with a talented person who makes you a better writer, who just happens to be your son or daughter. I don't know anyone else has ever done that. And we collaborate to this day. My deadline is on Wednesday. I'm always sending my weekly column to her, and she's always editing it, and she's always finding 10 grammatical mistakes in it, and or misspellings or syntax errors. I wonder how many of the editors over the last 20 years have thought I was just an idiot when I'd send out my column for all those mistakes. And traveling around with her and promoting this book, doing book readings and on the book tour, and it's just been wonderful because while I know the farm and food policy and politics of it, she knows the food side. She knows the market side. She's a fabulous cook, as is her mother, and she's very interested in it all. So it works out perfectly because these book readings and book stops have been opportunities to talk about food, not just farms. If farming's not about food, I don't know what it's about. It should be about food. We all talk about agriculture, and we shorten it to ag, and we shouldn't, because the word's agriculture, and that means food and people. That means culture. When you think about food in Europe, when you think about Europe, outside the Greek debt crisis right now, but even if you think about Greece, what do you think about? About the second thing, if not the first, is going to be food. Does the rest of the world think about that in America? We think about farms and big farms. We think about exports. We think about ethanol. We just really don't think about food. We used to. We used to be really well known for our food. If anything, this book, and while it's a memoir of sorts, a subtitle is Memories, I think it's a blueprint. I think it's where we're going to go back to. Definitely won't be my generation. It may not be your generation. But I'll bet you two generations from now, they'll be back to it. Simply because we know that we don't farm today like my father did 50 years ago.
Right.
We couldn't have imagined what farming 50 years from then would be. Couldn't imagine it. I think the same is true now. We can't possibly imagine what farming will be 50 years from today.
Right. But you think we can go back to bringing more people back in to more locally produced?
Already are. I think I read this right. I don't remember the exact statistics, but 20 years ago, there's something like 67 farmer markets around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Today, there's 12,000. Yeah, 12,000. So are we changing? You bet. Could we have seen it even that 20 years ago? No way. What are we going to do here Saturday? We're going to go to a farmer's market.
Right.
In Urbana. That's going to be a big deal. It is a big deal. You can't go anywhere any day of the week and not run into a farmer's market. You know what that reminds me of? Europe. Everywhere you go in Europe, there's a market every day within 4 or 5 miles of where you live. That's why refrigerators in Europe are the size of a suitcase, you know. They don't store stuff. They eat fresh every day. That's not a foreign idea, folks. That's the way we used to do it. So will we go back to what works? You're doggone right. We'll go back to what works. Will we go back to what's good? Always have. Will we go back to what makes the most sense? Sure, sure. Gracie likes to make the point that my mother, she couldn't wait to get off the farm and not have to can corn or peaches. But she does complain every day about how the food tastes that she eats now. It doesn't taste like back then. Well, we can fix that. We know how that works.
Well, that's very encouraging.
I'd bet the farm if I had the farm. The only food market that's growing in the United States is the organic market. And when you see what the big companies, like Hormel, the meat packer, Hormel's most known for what? Spam. They bought an organic meat packer a month ago. They spent $700 million to buy this organic meat company. Why? They're thinking Spam's not going to be around in 25 years is my best guess. And you've seen that time and time and time again. What's driving the big food companies? They're purchasing of organic companies to fold them into their lines. You go into Kroger supermarkets, they're renovating all their stores. The very center of their stores are all now being replaced with organic markets within their market. Why? The people are demanding. Everybody seems to have taken Econ 100, supply and demand. If the demand is there, you'll come up with the supply.
That makes a lot of sense.
Well, it makes for good eating, too. You know, think of all the farm-to-table experiences everybody talks about. You know the first farm-to-table restaurant? Was on the farm. We ate everything out of our garden and off the farm, went right to our table.
Right.
We ate the neighbor's eggs and we ate the neighbor's pork. We ate, drank our milk. So they had a little village there.
Yeah.
Civilization begins at the dinner table. You know, that's where real civility, real discourse, real ideas, real conversation, real love, real family starts. I was at the dinner table. And I'd only add that I would guess that there won't be another farm bill. The next farm bill would be a food bill because the farming community, they're working overtime just to maintain right now their political clout. And it's slipping away because the people, the eaters, the culture of agriculture wants something different. They want to go back to what it was. They want to go back to that goodness. We'll get there. They'll get there. I won't get there. And I hope this book helps people, encourages them a little bit, that everything that they hoped food was and will be, it can be again.
That was Alan Giebert, author of The Farm and Food File, a syndicated newspaper column, as well as a book he co-wrote with his daughter called The Land of Milk and Uncle Honey. I'm Amanda Hunnickfort. Thank you for listening.